Today's Teisho will be on Case 5 in the Book of Serenity, Jingyuan and the Price of Rice. Introduction. Siddhartha cut off his flesh to give to his parents. It is not listed in the legends of filial children. Devadatta pushed over a mountain to crush the Buddha, but did he fear the sound of sudden thunder? Having passed through the forest of thorns and cut down the sandalwood tree, just wait till the year ends. As of old, early spring is still cold. Where is the Buddha's body of reality? A monk asked Jingyuan, "What is the great meaning of Buddhism?" Jingyuan said, "What is the price of rice in Luling?" Verse. The accomplishing work of great peace has no sign. The family way of the peasants is most pristine, only concerned with village songs and festival drinking. How would they know of the virtues of Shun or the benevolence of Yao? Today is day two of our beautiful summer, early summer session. Really, really just a wonderful sitting. Last night and this morning, marvelous, really marvelous practice in this room. Everybody here is doing a magnificent job. It's really a great honor to practice with you. I have been practicing with some of you for more than a decade, and some of you for six or seven years, some for five or six, some for a couple of years. And in every case, it's really impressive to see so much growth. It's really wonderful. I hope that Gary won't mind if I mention that, many years ago, a number of years ago, Gary came to an introductory class at Rutgers, the introductory meditation class, with his wife, Joan. And at that time, on any Thursday night, I think we might have had, on a good Thursday, we might have had five people. And on the introductory class, often I would just come in, set up the mats, and sit there and wait for somebody to show up, and somebody might show up and somebody might not show up. I don't remember exactly the details, but at some point, Gary and Joan showed up. And it was a pleasure to meet them. And at that time, I think about 10 minutes was the limit for sitting. I think after about 10 minutes, that was where we had to stop. And if anybody's seen Gary sitting in the Zendo these days, it goes a lot longer than 10 minutes. Yeah. It goes through three sits. But I remember Gary telling me after maybe about a year that he was practicing every morning. He had to get up very early to sit in the morning and was making a point of sitting every morning, almost every morning. And I was impressed by that. That takes real determination. Maybe determination isn't quite the right word. Something's going on there. Not when somebody starts behaving that way. And, he just hasn't stopped. And it's really impressive. What is it that makes people do that anyway? You know, it's kind of a mystery. Because, I wanted to say determination, but that's not quite what this is about. But it's something deeper than determination, at least in the ordinary sense, because when we usually talk about determination, we're thinking about, say, strength of will, willpower, resolve. You know? So you might say to somebody, he has an iron will, she has an iron will. I'm not sure that Zen practice is about iron will. I don't think it is, personally. Somebody came into Dogo-san last night, and this person said something which many people have said over the years, and it's an interesting fact, you know. After a while, you can practice at home, or even on a Thursday night, and have a really deep sit, you know. So you can sit on your own for an hour or 2 hours and have a really deep sit. And then you come to sesshin, and it's an interesting fact that the sits don't seem quite as deep. You know, they don't. It's like you sit down on the cushion and, it doesn't seem quite as deep. And that's sort of another mystery of practice. Why is that? There's a lot we don't really understand about what we're doing. A monk asked Jinghuan, "What is the great meaning of Buddhism?" Jinghuan said, "What is the price of rice in Wu Ling?" Why are we doing this? This morning I got up from our sit. We had this beautiful morning sit. And I got up from the sit and I went into the kitchen. And I was just looking at like a towel hanging off the line. We have those, we put up those clotheslines in the kitchen to dry the rags. And I was just looking at that, and I just thought, whoa, you know, I am really deeply in it. You know, really, have you ever had that feeling where you feel, it doesn't always happen to you on the cushion, but sometimes off the cushion. You feel, you get off the cushion and you go outside and you look at something or you hear something. And it doesn't have to be anything special. It doesn't have to be like a beautiful flower or something. But you get this feeling that you're really deeply in something. It's like really deeply in something. I wonder if you've ever had that experience. Probably so. One way to explain that experience, which it comes to people who practice Zen, it is, and it took me years to understand that this is probably what it is, or at least this is one way to understand it. It's a deep sense of connection with everything around us, you know. I really, for years and years, I was practicing, and I would get this feeling. It's like sitting in the bottom of the ocean. It's as though everything around you has a certain kind of weight, or I don't know. It's just like being a fish at the bottom of the ocean and being aware of the water for the first time. But after a sit, sometimes I'll walk outside, and I just get this feeling. It's like I'm really in it. I don't know how to describe it. Probably it's indescribable, but you've probably felt it. And after about 30 years of having that feeling, it's occurred to me that that's a, That's a really deep sense of connection to everything around us. You know? And when we enter that state, it's really like returning home. It's really like everything is just as it is. This is like a natural condition of life, natural condition of life. Absolutely nothing special. There's nothing conceptual there, right? Nothing, no great insight, you know? It's not like when you're thinking, you know, I write, and I try to have ideas that are interesting to other people, even though I'm not always successful. And I'll write a paragraph, and I'll come back the next day and think, oh, nothing here, you know. And every once in a while, I'll hit a paragraph where I'll actually say something interesting and kind of surprise myself. Or I'll be reading in a book, and I'll just say, oh my gosh, that's a really striking insight. And there's a certain feeling you get when you have that, you know. Or you, if you like art, you go to the museum and you see a work by an artist and you think, wow, that's really something. Or if you like music, you hear a piece of music and you just think, wow, that's really beautiful, you know. Something different. But this experience is a little different. This feeling that you might have had is a little different because it doesn't take anything special. There's nothing required. It could just be you're sitting at the table and you're looking at a bowl of rice and you suddenly feel like you're home. I don't know how any other way to put it, but it's that feeling that everything's just where it should be. You know, everything's perfect just as it is, and I'm deeply in it. And this is really, I think, what Zen practice is all about, this state of mind. And you can't really make yourself enter it. Really, the truth is, the best way to get there is to, often we get there sort of by accident, right? I mean, we do have those experiences in daily life sometimes. The first time I ever, I think, had that experience really profoundly, personally, was I was on a hike with a friend of mine, and we went out walking after we pitched our tent in the evening. It was like a full moon evening, and my friend Larry and I were walking along a river. And that trail went along this river. It was called the Rapidan River in Virginia. And it was a summer night. It was a hot summer night. And the full moon was out and the light was coming through the trees. And it was making patterns of light and dark on the ground. And it was just like this amazing feeling of being deeply in something. You know? And I thought, geez, what is this feeling? And I actually said, do you feel it? And Larry might have said to me, do you feel it? And I said, yeah, that's the darndest thing, you know. And it didn't come back the next day, but I think that was the first time that ever happened to me. So I think it happens to everybody naturally in life, you know, just sort of accidentally. Another time that happened to me was at one time I was working on a construction job, and I used to have to wait by the road for my ride to come and pick me up, and we'd drive together in a carpool to the construction job. And there were some flowers growing by the side of the road. You might have seen them. They're actually these little blue flowers that grow around the middle of the summer. They're like daisies, only they're blue. And the center is also blue, I think, or it might be yellow. But the leaves are blue. And they're actually chicory flowers. But anyway, they're really like a common weed. A lot of people look at them as a weed. And I was sitting waiting for this car to show up, and I was looking at this flower, and I just had that wonderful feeling of well-being, connectedness. And then my ride came, and I sort of, you know, I mean, I remember it even today. There's nothing special about having these kinds of experiences. I think we all have them, all of our lives. So you can probably remember times in your life when you felt this sense of being deeply in it, you know. You think back, moments, there might be nothing special going on, but often they happen by accident, you know. And, if you come to Sesshin, eventually, maybe not your first Sesshin or your second Sesshin, but I think sooner or later you'll begin to have these moments where you just feel this deep sense of being at home, being connected. And there's nothing to it. It's not like you're going to have some great insight. You know, it's all one. See, that's just an idea. That has nothing to do with this experience. But I think this experience is really the heart of Zen practice. See, perhaps, it is necessary to try. It is necessary to try. You can't get to this just by, we could get up at 8 o'clock, for example, and have breakfast at 9, and we could loll about the grounds, you know, we could just stroll. But I don't think you'd have these moments. I really don't. I think they're very hard. It's hard to hit them. And one of the things that I think has to be the case is that we have to sort of be beyond ourselves a little bit. We have to sort of be receptive or empty. And so all of this hard work on the cushion is really not aiming at achieving an answer to something. It's just trying to be receptive enough for that experience to happen. Which is I think this is an important difference, you know. I mean, in Zen tradition, there's so much emphasis on self-discipline and effort, great faith, great doubt, great determination. And determination, you know, you grit your teeth, you pull your legs up, and you're trying to hit the bullseye. But you really hit the bullseye after you've been sitting for a while. You pulled your legs up, you're trying, and then you sort of say, oh, well, I'll never hit the bullseye. And then, you know, you put your bow and arrow down and you look up at the sky and suddenly you think, wow, I'm deeply in it. See, maybe it had nothing to do with the target or the arrow at all. Now, those were just to busy the discriminating mind until you could get back to this place. But this experience is really what Zen practice is all about. So all of this is just a way of sort of getting the small self out of the way. And this is just a means of getting the small self out of the way so we can get back to our natural state. So it's not like we have a goal and we're shooting for the goal. Actually, what we're just trying to do is to stop at shooting for the goal, is to stop shooting for a goal. But that's actually very hard for humans to do. It's actually very hard for us to just be in the moment. And because, in fact, we're very goal-directed creatures. And the essence of being a human being is to create some kind of a story about ourselves. And, you know, I think maybe we all do this, don't we? When I was a little kid, I used to, you know, walk around having fantasies in my mind where I was I'd see a movie, and see myself as a warrior, you know, I'd be fighting, or whatever. You know, kids have these crazy ideas, but I would remember, you know, seeing some kind of a movie with soldiers, and I would think about being a soldier. And I would have little fantasies, and you know, you have when we were kids, we used to play forts, I mean, this probably happens everywhere in the world, I guess, but in our neighborhood, some of the kids would dig holes in the ground, and we'd have a hole over here on one side and a hole over here on the other side, and we'd dig and we'd build our forts, and then we'd attack each other's forts. It's slightly depressing, even kids do this, you know. But this is what we used to do. And, you know, we each would want to conquer the other person's fort. And this is so human, right? You know, this goal-directed aspect of ourselves is really central. And I guess the Zen approach is to say, okay, go for the goal. Go for the goal. And grit your teeth, pull up your legs. And there's something to that, actually. You know, as I say, if we got up at, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning and we had a late lunch or brunch, you know, and so on, none of the good things that are happening would be happening. But they're happening not because we're finally achieving our goal, but because we're finally letting all goals go. See, when in the Mumonkan, in the Master Mumon's, Master Umen's discussion of the Mukong, he says, if you're going to practice Zen, it's like walking up a mountain of swords in your bare feet. And I remember the first time Genki Roshi read that, and I actually got butterflies in my stomach. I was like, whoa, you know, this is scary. Right? And I think that he also, Master Mumon also says, and the road to enlightenment is littered with skulls, the skulls of the dead. It's like, whoa, oh my God, are you tough enough? Are you? But it's all a joke, see? It's like, maybe we have to suffer long enough to know that, you know, we don't really have to suffer. You know what I mean? Now, I'm not saying kick back, see? Because if you say, okay, I don't have to suffer, you know, I'm going to uncross my legs, I'm going to kick back, you know. But these moments of being deeply in it, deeply connected, probably won't come. You'll get bored quickly. And then, you know, if you were comfortable and you were in ordinary consciousness, you'd be bored quickly, because ordinary consciousness is a goal-directed consciousness. You say, well, what's doing it? Is there a newspaper around here? Something to read? No? It's inevitable. That's ordinary consciousness, right? You say, well, I'm going crazy here, you know. So basically that wouldn't work, you know. You kind of have to walk up the mountain of skulls and swords, and about halfway up you go, this isn't a mountain of swords. It's beautiful here. You know, and the mountain goes on and on forever, and I just love walking up the mountain, you know, because every moment is the top of the mountain. You know, that takes some effort to get there, but when you get there, you realize there isn't really a goal, so to speak. It's all goal. It's all goal. It's all the top. Every place is the top of the mountain. And I think we all have these experiences at Sesshin sometimes. They usually come, you know, when we least expect it. And by the way, you know, koans are a strange thing, aren't they? They're kind of, you know, the great Hakuin Zenji called them those vile koans. And I think they are vile in a way. You know, I love them, actually, because they really do open up a lot. But it's such a strange thing to sit in the Dokusan room and somebody might come into Dokusan and they'll talk about their day of practice, and it's just been a beautiful day of practice, you know. Then maybe they'll make a presentation, and I'll say, well, you're not quite done with the koan yet, or that's not quite it, or there's another aspect. And, you know, I always hope the person doesn't go away thinking the day was a waste. You know, because in a way, you know, whether you answer your koan or not, if you have that experience of being deeply in it, you know, you're really there already. You're really there already. So the koan is just like a way of, there are actually answers, so to speak, responses to the koan that show a psychological transformation. And they're actually specific kinds of insights that have to happen. So that's true. That's actually, I swear to you, that's the truth. But at the same time, you know, you can go through the whole day with the sense of being deeply in it and have this wonderful sense of being alive and open-hearted. And, you know, you may not answer the call on that day, but that's okay. You know, it's going to come when it's going to come, right? It's like, the proper attitude towards Zen practice is being like a gardener. You know, you're cultivating your garden every day. And so, you know, if you're too obsessed with the crops, you're not going to be happy, right? You know, it's true, the purpose of a garden is to have some crops. So, you know, you've got your pepper plants, and you've got your tomatoes, and you have your squash and zucchini. And naturally, you want to have them. And that's why you planted the garden, in a way. But, you know, if you go out and you work in the garden, you begin to feel happy, right? Isn't it, you know, one of the interesting things about gardening is that even people who are kind of grouchy can garden, and they begin to get a little sweeter, you know. It's interesting. We used to have a pea patch in Seattle, where my wife and I used to live. The city of Seattle had some large public spaces that it would raffle off to people for a small garden called pea patches. And we won a garden just near our house, as a matter of fact. So it was great. And we grew all kinds of things on the southern slope. It was like the ideal garden site. And there was a friend of mine also who was a law student. Michael was his name. And Michael was really a grouch, you know, but I'd see it. I mean, truly, a cynic and a grouch, you know. But I would see him out there gardening, and I'd go out, and he'd have a big smile on his face, and his garden was terrible. It was awful. It was like a junkyard, almost. You know. But he was happy, you know. And there's something about, you know, so if you're too crop-obsessed, you know, you think, I've got, you know, these got to be the biggest tomatoes. You know, I mean, my father actually had the wrong idea when he would garden. My father got into gardening at one time, and it was crazy, right? I mean, I swear to you, I love my father, but many things he did were just like really not in the Tao, you know. And I learned from that. I owe my father a tremendous debt of gratitude because I've learned so much from his mistakes. It's like, if I could repay my father for helping me so much, I wish I could, you know. My father, he got into gardening. He wanted to have like the biggest tomatoes on the base, the military base. So, you know, he got a rototiller and he rototilled, and then he actually, I swear this is the truth, I swear. My father actually built a frame with a mesh, and set mesh in the frame so we could sift the rocks out of the dirt, you know. And I, actually, to tell you the truth, my wife does, she doesn't go that far, but she pulls all the rocks out. And I feel like, look, rocks are part of the dirt, you know. Rocks are always in the dirt, you know. And if you take all the rocks out, they're going to come up again. They come up out of the ground. So my father sifted all the rocks out of the dirt so that it was just like rockless. And he planted his tomatoes, and then he wanted these giant tomatoes, so he over-fertilized. And he got huge tomatoes that never ripened. They just stayed green because he figured it out after a while. But he was too crop-obsessed, right? You know, the thing is, you want to plant your crops and enjoy your crops, know, enjoy your garden, right? Plant your plants, and enjoy it. So you get up in the morning and you go out and you water, and you look at the plants, and if you see like some bugs, maybe there's something you can pull the bugs off the plant, or if you see some slugs, you can gather them up in a can and take them away from the garden, take them somewhere else. You can, you know, make sure they're watered. You can add some fertilizer if you want. You know, and it's just a joy to be out there. And, you know, at the end of the summer, at least if you're a gardener like I am and my wife, you know, we don't really get that many vegetables, really. It's in a certain sense, it's not really worth it, right? I mean, you probably get a bag of tomatoes at the end of the summer. And if you gave it a monetary value, it would probably be $10, you know? And same thing with peppers and, you know, we don't really grow enough for it to be, probably we break even on the plants. Maybe we don't. It probably actually costs us money to grow these vegetables. So, you know, they are good. Usually the tomatoes are really good, because, you know, they're a kind of tomato that wasn't built to be shipped across the United States, and so they're tender and tasty, but it wasn't really the point, was it? It was really being in a garden, listening to the birds, and that beautiful sense of being deeply in it. So I think the proper spirit for Zen practice is not walking up the mountain of swords, although if you want to do it, do it. Now feel free. But the proper spirit is to be a good gardener of your heart and mind and body, and of this beautiful world. And that's what you're doing all day long on the cushion. It's like gardening. You're pulling up the weeds. Yeah, it's like weeding your mind, right? You know, so you keep gently bringing your mind back to the koan. And then, you know, you're in the moment, you're in the moment, you're in the moment, and you come back to your koan. Something comes up, you see it, and it goes away, and something else comes up, and it goes away. See, this is like a gardener's mind. This is the proper spirit for Zen practice. And, you know, sooner or later, there's going to be tomatoes there, you know. It took me 5 years to answer the breath perception koan. It took me a number of years to answer the mu koan. You know, how long it takes is really not the point. It's developing a deep way of life. Now, this is about a deep way of life. See, modern people are so goal-oriented that they don't really appreciate, I think, personally, are too goal-oriented. They don't understand the joy of sheer being, just being, just existing, which is as common as dirt, and it's precious beyond belief. I mean, one of the reasons we're so obsessed with material things is that we just don't see that now, each of these moments is like heaven. You know, it's just this wonderful, wonderful... Right here is heaven. Right here. If you can just be in this mind, this sort of gardener's mind, you know. It's right here. You may not always feel that way. You know, when your legs are hurting, or you're tired, you know. It's hard to have gardener's mind, but even with pain, you know, if you're trying to get out of pain, it's unlikely that it's going to happen. You know, you just have to say, okay, I'm in pain, I don't know how long it's going to last, and I'm just going to have the gardener's mind. But, you know, I'm going to work with the breath, I'm going to sweep the pain away. If it comes back, I'm going to sweep it away. It's just like pulling weeds, right? Just like pulling weeds. And at some point, you know, you're going to look down the row and all the weeds are gone. You're going to feel good about your day, you know. You may not have a pain-free sit today, But you're at the end of the day, see, you'll probably feel good even though you didn't have a pain-free sip. You probably have moments during the day where you just feel, wow, I'm deeply in it. This is really, I think, the proper spirit for Zen practice. It's not the warrior's way, you know. I mean, people who are attracted to Zen actually have a kind of warrior sensibility. This is a theory of mine, but I think it's true. You know, I think Zen appeals to people who have a kind of warrior spirit, myself included. You know, there's a kind of warrior-like element in Zen tradition. You know, the swords, the shouting, you know, all of this stuff. I think this is intentional. You know, Zen is sort of the method that's for people who are, if you don't mind my saying so, they're sort of like, generally speaking, they kind of have a, I guess warrior is the best way to put it, sort of a warrior sensibility. But being a warrior is not such a good thing, actually. Not so good for us as individuals, and it's not so good for the world. The Buddha was like this, actually. Siddhartha was from the warrior class, you could say, and was educated in all the arts of being a warrior. And sometimes when he talks about Zen meditation practice, rather, he uses metaphors from his military training. But he gave it up, right? And I think that Zen is designed to appeal to people who have this powerful warrior sensibility. But then that's a little dangerous, because I think part of becoming a man of Zen or a woman of Zen is realizing that the warrior is really not the path, right? It's the farmer, that's the path. So we're going to put down our swords and we're going to become farmers. This is really very important, you know. That farmer's mind, you know, farmer gets up and he tends his crops, or she tends her crops, and you don't know, is it going to rain today or not? Right? And you hope for rain. You know, your crops are getting tired, they need water. And you look up in the sky and you know, there's no cloud in sight. You know, you can worry. You know, and you could maybe go to the river and bring some water up. But you have to trust. You have to trust. Because it's bigger. It's a bigger, you know, you trust in the bigger world. And you can't make it rain, right? You know, and you can't. Whatever people say, you can do dances or rituals, you will not make it rain. That's pure superstition. It doesn't rain, it's not going to rain. You know, if you're a farmer, you're either going to have like a nervous breakdown, or you're going to enter a bigger mind, right? And sometimes there wasn't rice to eat, so people ate buckwheat, right? That's the way it goes. That's the farmer's life. And buckwheat is delicious, right? I love rice myself, but buckwheat, you have to eat buckwheat. That's the way it goes. So this is the mind of practice. You know, this is the proper spirit. It's like you're cultivating your garden. And you know the crops are going to come in sometime. Maybe today, and maybe not today. So your job isn't to harvest the crops today. Your job is just to tend the garden. And you may one day come out to the garden and say, oh my gosh, here they are. Look at these tomatoes. Right? Delicious. And if that happens, it's a wonderful day. But guess what? If it doesn't happen, also a wonderful day. Also a wonderful day. So this is the spirit. Please have this spirit. Farmer's mind. Farmer's mind. Now, you know, if you don't put anything in the ground, nothing's going to happen. You say, oh, hey, I'm a farmer. I don't even plant. I take, you know, that's going to be sad. So you have to, you know, it's actually hard work to be a good farmer. And it takes constant attentiveness, right? Because, you know, basically, you know, you want to make sure the soil, you look at the soil, maybe you compost, and you want to make sure that compost is mixed in well with the soil. You want to make sure the plants are in the right spots. So, you know, the beans need to be in shade, but the tomatoes need to be in the sun. And you have to sort of look at where the sun goes and so on. You try to find the best place for each plant. And you help each plant along in a different way, right? But so this is just like meditation practice. You know, you're tending your garden, but you're attentive. You're looking for weeds, you know, making sure your posture is correct. And then, you know, basically if you're doing your job as a gardener, you should feel happy with your practice. And I hope you can love it. Right? It's just like some people just love gardening, they feel deeply in it. And if you just have gardener's mind, you know, all day long you could be happy. You know, just try, but then let nature, we say in English, a beautiful phrase, letting nature take its course. Right? Please let nature take its course. And things will ripen in their time. And that's the most beautiful, one of the most beautiful things about life. You know? Apples come in the fall, not in the spring. You know, we go to the grocery store, we can buy apples anytime. We forget. You know, it takes so much patience before there's an apple. So much patience before there's a cantaloupe. You know, if you grow melons, you have to go out there. Sometimes the good farmers go out there and they turn the melon. You know, actually, you have to go out and turn each melon. And then at the end of the summer, you know, beautiful melon. So, this is the spirit. A monk asked Jing Wan, "What is the great meaning of Buddhism?" Jing Wan said, "What is the price of rice moving? The accomplishing work of great peace has no sign." There's no idea. It's not about an idea. When you encounter fundamental reality, it's a signless realm. It's a nameless realm. The family way of the peasants is most pristine. This is the family way of the farmers. It's the most pristine. This is the best way, the farmer's way. Only concerned with village songs and festival drinking. See, I mean, this isn't a put-down. See, saying those farmers, they don't care about highfalutin ideas. They don't know anything about the virtues of Shun or the benevolence of Yao. They never heard of them. See, what are they concerned about? Just hoeing, weeding, drinking cool water on a hot day, see, eating rice. That's all those people care about. And people think peasants, you know, how stupid. That's it, the deepest wisdom, right? As we know, just being in it. Just being in it.